Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
As soon as I walk in, I hear it click. They locked it. I was like, oh, man, I ain't getting out of here. This don't look good. You know, I got a guy behind me with the door locked. I got a guy standing over here. I can see the carotid artery in his neck beating, bounces, boom, boom, boom. And I'm like, oh, and on the table, there's a Tupperware container with a red lid, and there's shards of crystal meth. I'm not kidding you. They're 9-10 inches long, and they're big around as my wrist. Wow. They're massive. That's the best dope I've ever seen.
Hey, look at you guys. You came back for part two this week, didn't you? Because you want to hear more stories coming out of Nebraska. From our guest this week is Dutch McAlpin, 20-plus years in law enforcement. And by the way, welcome back to Game of Crimes. I guess I should have started with that, but I think you know where you are. I am honored that you come back on these shows, and today is going to be a much better than yesterday because we were just getting started. So Dutch is now, he's still in the National Guard. He's been a deputy sheriff. Well, he started out as a jailer, then he becomes a deputy sheriff, and now he's with the City Police Department, which is a suburb of Omaha. So you're talking, I think, 110-man department plus the Metro City Task Forces you talked a little about yesterday. And then I think there's this thing called Federal Task Forces, right? But before we touch on that, how did you decide that you wanted to try undercover? I mean, you're kicking butt and taking names with these trash pulls and search warrants and getting people to flip and everything. Where did the UC thing come from?
I mean, I was fascinated by it from the start. You know, I think during source development, you know, I'm talking when we take down a meth lab back in Montgomery County, instead of just booking the guy in and throwing him in jail and that's the end of it, I would be like, Are you the best meth cook? What makes you the best? And I would have them detail everything out to me. So I'm learning so much information from these guys. And then when I went to the city, when I'd make an arrest, find an 8-ball of coke or meth or whatever, instead of booking them in, I'd be like, let me see your phone. Who do you call? What about this? What about that? Tell me about this. And I started to become fascinated. And I'm not going to say that I liked these people, but I started to feel very comfortable around them. And
right.
I started to realize too, like sources are snitches and snitches are sources, and they always have a motivation. And anytime that it's not a professional law enforcement person in there, we're opening up a lot of room for failure, loopholes. They steal, they lie, they entrap, they do things they're not supposed to do sometimes. And I thought, man, if I could get in there with them, we can get a much more true perspective of what's happening, if you will. So anyway, I was excited about it. I wanted to do it. I just thought it was fun. I wanted the adrenaline, you know? So I went in undercover.
There you go.
I'm doing it.
There's the addiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, you roll on a code 3 call. If your adrenaline's not pumping, you're not a normal person.
Oh yeah. It's so fun. It's so fun.
And then, and the car chases, I mean, that's the most fun thing at all. You get to drive like a maniac and it's legal.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know,
that's the truth.
Yeah. And you know what? I got enough car chases after a while. I was like, I don't want to do any more car chases. Them things stress you out. You know what I mean? People get in trouble and people get hurt and people wreck. And if you want to end up on the professional standards interrogation and interview room, it's generally
evening.
That's
news.
Right. That's right. But yeah, I mean, I'm not saying I didn't like doing it, but I recognize that was a quick way to getting hurt or getting fired. So working undercover, I mean, plus I was tired of wearing a uniform. You know, I want to have a beard. I want to have long hair. I want to drive a low rider and do cool shit. I don't want to, everybody's wearing a uniform. I want to not wear a uniform. I want to be one of them guys.
But you want the guys in uniform going, I want to be like him someday.
Oh yeah, of course. They usually love when you come to training and I get to have a ponytail and a beard and, you know, maybe I don't even have a gun on, you know, we're doing EVOC training and I'm getting in a Chief's patrol car, his brand new Dodge Charger, and I'm doing burnouts in it. You know what I mean?
Again, perks of the job.
Yeah, for sure.
I love it. So do you remember what your very first undercover role was?
Oh, dude, it was buying some.
And I mean, you know, undercover roles, you can be the principal undercover, or you can be, you know, you can be support. You can be the, you know, the eye candy that's going with the real undercover, that kind of thing. So just curious, what was your first one?
Well, by no means, this isn't me boosting my own ego or trying to say I'm anything that I just am what I am, telling a story. We didn't have an undercover program. There wasn't anybody working undercover. And I had a Lieutenant Wood. I said, hey, man, I've talked to this source. And he says he can take me in there and introduce me to this guy, and I can start buying the dope. And he thought it was a good idea. I think it was probably less than an ounce of weed, to be honest with you. But it was kind of like a trial run. You know what I mean? Like, let's not do anything too crazy or jeopardize a serious, significant case. Let's just see how this works. And I was successful quick and easy and fast, to the point that, I mean, it wasn't hard at all anymore, you know? So I'm buying guns, I'm buying drugs, I'm buying marijuana. Marijuana was illegal at the time, but it wasn't a priority of ours. It was just, that you make 2-3 buys off this guy selling weed and be like, no, anybody sells coke? Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. It was just a means to turn a next informant. You know what I mean? And I know that's what we were doing. So I think I was buying some weed off of some kid who was maybe 19 or 20 years old, and it wasn't much more than an ounce probably at the time.
And how did that – so, well, first of all, the other narcs are seeing you do this. Yeah. Are they wanting to try it?
Not really. I thought everybody wanted to be undercover, you know what I mean? I would think everybody wants to do it, but I think it takes a certain kind of confidence. It's almost like some guys are great at briefing a search warrant and writing up the documents and presenting in court, but they're a terrible public speaker, you know? And I think it can be very challenging to go into something unscripted. And also, working undercover requires that you put your badge and your gun away. And when you've worked your whole career wearing a badge of authority and this gun on your hip, and people look at you and like, what should I do? When you take that badge and that gun off, it's a different mindset. You know, they don't have to listen to you. They don't see you as a person of authority. They see you as one of them or less. So it's a whole different program. So they didn't really want to do it. And I got to do it all the time. I never stopped. And that's when the feds found me.
So which federal agency was the first one to come along?
Well, we did a lot of work with the DEA. And I don't know how it was across the rest of the nation, but the DEA division in Omaha there had some pretty specific rules about working undercover. I was going into houses and apartment complexes, sitting down on a couch and buying dope and stuff. And they had some pretty strict rules on not going inside of a residence and setting up deals in public places.
Right.
And it was kind of confining, and it was kind of investigatively didn't make a lot of sense. I think it's safe. I think it's smart. And I think there's ways to work around it, but I was kind of cocky and wanted to do it my way. So we did a lot of stuff with DEA, but it was mostly surveillance and a lot of source buys. I don't remember any undercovers doing DEA buys, but I was doing undercover buys on our Metro Drug Task Force. And I started to get to where I was pretty good at getting into the Mexicans. I mean, to be honest with you, you know, in Miami, the Colombians control the cocaine. And in Omaha, Nebraska, right, in the Midwest, the Mexicans control the methamphetamine trade. And that's a real life story. That's just the way it is. So I didn't speak Spanish, but I was very comfortable in those communities. I would go to the taco truck and order tacos and burritos off there, you know, and go eat the restaurants and hang out and just be seen and just kind of be regularly seen. And I got to be familiar and comfortable there. And one day this guy named Greg from the FBI, it was the FBI who basically intimately brought me onto their undercover program. And he said, we've got a high level source who's in trouble. He's running a car dealership in Omaha, and he's been providing information. They've been bringing in loads of dope, and he's been helping us with this case. There was a couple other buys that I did for the FBI with Mike. They were kind of low-level gang cases where I'd buy a gun off of somebody or buy some crack cocaine off of somebody, but it wasn't anything that was like like CPOT or like nationally or globally connected. It was still local stuff. But Greg had found out that I was able to assimilate in this Hispanic community. It was predominantly Mexicans. There was a meatpacking area down there. There was a, all of South Omaha is a Hispanic area. Wonderful people down there. Not all of them are bad, not by any means, but it's just part of life. It's real life, you know? And he says, we got a high level source. One of the ones that we pay a lot of money, you know, the ones I'm talking about. And he's in trouble. He basically, he had set up a, they brought in a load of dope and he had set up a dope deal for like $50,000 worth of meth and they fronted it and the guy didn't pay him. And he basically was like, they showed up, they sent up a couple of sicarios and they brought a list of his family members down in Mexico and they're going to kill him. And
oh no.
Yeah. And they're like, and he doesn't owe him 50,000 anymore. He owes him 100,000. And so the idea was that they would introduce me. So this guy, oh, we'll call him Sanchico. Sanchico is the quote unquote source. And he's the one that's also in trouble. Then they were like, the idea was that Sanchico said, well, I have a buyer, a gringo that, you know, he can buy. He always buys. He can buy. And they were going to introduce me to these guys that were sent up from Mexico to enforce whatever debt Sanchico had. And they thought, well, we'll send Dutch in there and he'll buy a pound or two of meth off these guys. We'll take them off. And then he'll be safe again, right? And it makes sense because there's always a great plan, but the plan doesn't always work out the way we planned. You know what I'm saying?
It never works out.
And I'd been working undercover for quite a while. I mean, at least locally at a metro level. And so I kind of knew the street pretty well. You know, I carried a set of digital scales with me. I knew how to count money. I knew how to weigh dope. I knew about that stuff. And I, and he's like, well, we need you to do it today. And I'm like, I haven't even met the source. I don't know who he is. Like, that's probably not the best idea, but I was pretty cocky.
And the source's source are sicarios.
Yeah. Oh, for sure, dude. When I describe them, you'll understand what I'm saying here. So the source owns a car dealership. And on one side of the building, it's got like it's got all the Lomas, Serrano, MS-13, all the local street gang guys have graffitied it up. There's cars in the parking lot that are like for sale, but they're not nice cars or anything like that. It's a buy here, pay here lot. And what they've been doing is they've been bringing these cars up from Mexico and unloading dope out of the fender wells or whatever they transported in. And then this source Sanchico had been setting up buyers for this dope. And now he'd gotten himself into trouble. But apparently they were pretty concerned about him because these guys had checked into hotel. They weren't planning on staying long. So I think they were probably going to whack him out and take the whatever they could get for the money of the debt and probably go back down to Mexico and start over again. But I, knowing it was probably irresponsible and I shouldn't do it, I agreed to do it. And I show up in a parking lot and I hadn't even met the FBI agent before. Turns out he's a great guy. We became very good friends and he put me in such a great place career wise. But he handed me, I think no kidding, Steve, at the time, I think a pound of meth was around $12,000. Wow. It was $12,000 for a pound. And so they gave me like 12 grand. I had real long hair with hair ties in it. And I was like, this doesn't look right. Like, I'm not going to walk in there with a stack of 12 grand. Like, here's the money. Let me take the dope and leave. Like, I know it ain't going to work that way. So I pulled out a bunch of the hair ties and I'd wrapped the money up into smaller amounts. And I'd put like 5 grand in a pocket, some down my pants, some of my socks, and some of my back pockets. Because I'd kind of seen guys don't just walk into a room and flash their money. That's a good way to get robbed and ripped and shot and killed. And they're like, don't worry. It's just going to be you, this source of ours. And then they didn't call him a sicario. That's just what I call him to give you an idea. It'll just be you two. It'll be no big deal. I'm like, okay, which one's Sanchico? Because I haven't even seen the guy. Met him before, shook his hand or anything. I'm going to have to figure out which one he is when I get in the room. This is dumb, right? But I'm you know, I got an ego. FBI needs my help. I'm there to help. I'll show these guys what's up. I got the money. And I drive down this car dealership, and I pull up out front. And there's six Mexicans working in the garage. I'm like, oh, there's already more than they said there's going to be here. I'm like, Sanchico? And they look at me like I'm crazy. They're like, see? And they point me to like an office area in the back. Kind of had like a makeshift like showroom floor there. And I make my way through there. Got my money. I got my nice clothes on. I look like I'm in charge. And I see a little Hispanic Mexican guy standing in the doorway of this office. And I'm like, Sanchico. He's like, si, come. And I walk right through the door. I don't hesitate. I don't ask any questions. I walk right through the door. And as soon as I walk in, I hear it click. They locked it. And it probably went a lot faster than I remember, but I thought it must have been like 30 seconds. But I stopped. I took a deep breath. I looked around. I was like, oh, man, I ain't getting out of here. This don't look good. You know, I got a guy behind me with the door locked. I got a guy standing over here. There's a black roller chair back in the corner where it should be behind the desk. It's in the corner. And there's this guy, and he's sitting back. He looks really stressed out. I can see the carotid artery in his neck beating, bounces, boom, boom, boom. And I'm like, oh, and on the table, there's a Tupperware container with a red lid, and there's shards of crystal meth. I'm not kidding you. They're 9-10 inches long. Ooh. And they're big around as my wrist. Wow. They're massive. That's the best dope I've ever seen. And
are you wired up?
I don't remember. I might have had a transmitter on me. Honestly, I don't remember. Yeah, I probably, but I think I was, but they couldn't hear me because you know how that works. Once you go into 2-3 rooms, no one's hearing you anymore. And they're kind of just guessing that you're okay if they aren't hearing. If you're not running out and they're not hearing gunshots, I guess they assume you're okay, right? But I see Sanchico in the corner. And I'm assuming that's my source. That's the guy that I'm supposed to know. And I reach down, I grab one of them shards of meth, and I get real excited. I'm like, whoa. I'm like, that's what I'm talking about. I'm like, that's the shit I've been looking for. I look over at Sanchico, and I give him a knuckle bump, and he has this ghost white look on his face like, oh. And we bump knuckles, and I take some of the money out of my pocket. I'm like, well, who's the man? Who's getting paid? And everybody's just sitting in there. It's like a standoff, you know what I mean? Everybody's looking at each other like, who's robbing who? What's going to happen? And I looked at
They're wondering, who's this crazy white guy?
Yeah, for sure. And it was definitely distractionary. It was definitely a distractionary technique. And I'm not going to say I was scared. You know what I mean? I definitely recognize, like, I've just been locked in a room with a bunch of guys that don't give a shit who I am. And I've got money and the dope's there. And this guy's already backed in a corner. So he's not no value to me at all. He has no authority in here. And I hand the guy, I go, you ain't the guy. I look around the guy behind the door that's got the door locked. I go, you ain't the man. You better start counting money. I boss him. You better start counting money. He comes up to the desk. He starts counting money. It ain't that much, a few grand. And I'm like, what about you? You better start counting money too. And I pull some more money out and I put it on the desk. I'm like, you better start counting money. And there's a guy sitting behind the desk. And he's got a black shirt buttoned up, black pants. His hair is perfect. I'm telling you, his eyes are black. And he's a serious looking guy. And I'm like, you're the man. I'm like, you're the man. And I go, that ain't all the money. And he looked at me, like, kind of glared at me, like, why are you bossing my guys around? You know, who are you? And I take out the rest of the money. And I'm like, I hand it to him. And I go, and that ain't all the money. And I go, this. And he probably doesn't speak much English, but we're having a good dialect. You know what I'm saying? And I'm like, this is what I'm looking for. I got another 12 grand. I'll go get it. Can you give me another pound of this? I'll be back in less than an hour. And he stopped counting money for a second. He looked up and he was like, see. And I think he probably thought, I mean, no way to tell, right? He probably thought, well, let's get another 12 grand off of him. Because there's no way they were going to let him leave. Yeah, before we kill him. And I'm wrapping this dope up as fast as I can. Like, you know, I'll get the – I'm making it sound like I did such a great job. But honestly, I'm probably like, I got another 12 grand back there. I'll take this and I'll be right back and I'll give you another 12 grand. You know, I'm trying to get out of there. And I unlock the door and I walk out. I probably ran out. You know what I mean? I was like, I'm getting out of here right now. This is one sketchy situation. Well, the surveillance team stayed on those guys. And they sure enough left and went back to wherever they were. And they got another Tupperware container full of dope. And they were driving back to the car dealership. They pulled them over. And it looked like a traffic stop. And these guys got caught with the dope. They indicted them. They took them off. They had over a pound of crystal on them. And Sanchico was now relieved of his debt because they basically didn't tie that to him. They were just thought the guys got pulled over. They were illegal. They weren't supposed to be there anyway, and they got taken off. And Sanchico and I developed a good relationship with each other. He felt like I had saved him. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah,
you did.
Yeah, well, not intentionally, but yeah, definitely saved him. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you might have been trying to save yourself, but he took advantage of it also.
I saved him that day, but not forever. And the FBI says, you know, you're pretty good at this. We want to send you to our undercover program. It's the UCE undercover program.
Oh yeah. No kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, I mean, that was a weird experience for me too, because I'm a TFO. I'm not an FBI agent, and I don't know if the DEA does that, but they had a lot of task force officers that played pretty good roles within their investigative units. And I was actually assigned to a Safe Streets gang unit task force. So even though we weren't a drug unit, as long as there was a gang nexus, we would do drug investigations, obviously, because it's easier to get somebody on a dope charge than it is a murder charge when nobody's a witness and nobody's talking. So a lot of our gang investigations were that. But anyway, they fly me out to an offsite in Virginia, and they put me through an assessment. And it's like a mental health assessment and a written test and all this crazy stuff. And I'm just a street cop that don't know nothing about the federal system, but I'm excited. I mean, I feel very proud. I'm excited. And I walk into this office.
That's one of the top notch undercover schools in the world, as far as I know.
Yeah, it's serious. It's serious. And I remember the assessment. I guess if you can't make fun of yourself, you can't make fun of anybody else, right? But I knock on this door and I give the secret password, if you will. And I walk into like a waiting area. It kind of looks like a small doctor's clinic. And there's a bunch of guys sitting around in this table. And apparently they must do the assessment at the same time. And nobody's talking. I'm wearing a pair of pressed Dickies and a white t-shirt. And I ain't got nothing else. These guys are wearing suit and ties. And I look over this one guy and I'm like, who are you? And he's like, I am Yosef. I'm like, where are you from? He's like, East Dallas. And I'm like, no, I mean, really, where are you from? And he's like, wherever he said, you know. And I'm like, you speak any other languages? He's like, I speak 6 languages and I have a master's degree. And I'm like, I'm not getting this job. No way, you know. So I decided I'm just going to tell the truth and do the very best I can. And at least if anything else, when I leave this place, I'll have a good assessment of what I'm made of. And I take the MMPI. We all know what that is. And I take all these other written tests. Typing them, wearing the cubicle blinders are up. It's kind of like that show Men in Black when they bring him to where they test him for the alien hunting job, you know. I'm taking a test, and I'm the first one done. And it's yes, no, true, false questions. The next test is complete each sentence. And then there was a like basic skills test, right? A problem solving test. I take all the tests. I'm done. I'm feeling pretty good. And finally, we're all split up now. We're going in and out. You take the test, then you go see a liaison, then you go see a doctor, and then they make a full assessment of whether or not they think you're going to fit in this program. And this doctor, she calls me in. She was a wonderful lady, smart. She was Colombian. Yeah. And she brings me in. She goes, I want to talk to you about your test. And I'm like, okay. And she goes, you realize you failed every problem-solving question on the test? I'm like, oh, I guess I'm done, huh? I can go. And she's like, no, I want to talk to you a little more. I'm like, okay. She goes, some of the guys out there got 100%, but we're looking for a unique type of personality because they think a little bit too abstract. And for the kind of work that we want you to do, you can't be an abstract thinker. You got to be able to make decisions on the go. And I think you can agree to that working undercover. There's no game plan. You just got to wing it sometimes. Right. But she goes, I got some questions for you first. I'm like, all right. She goes, the sentence, it was one of them tests where you complete each sentence. They give you a fraction of a sentence and then you finish it. And this, I found out later, these tests are designed to basically point out certain personality traits and certain mental health traits that have helped them identify people that have a better opportunity of being successful. So they're not wasting time and money. People don't get hurt or killed, and they aren't as susceptible to becoming one of the bad guys, if you will, right? So she goes, all right, we got some questions for you. Goes, the first question is, the question says, my mother is. And she goes, your complete sentence is loving, period. And I'm like, yeah. She goes, why'd you say that? I said, well, because my mom had me when she was very young. She was 36 when I graduated from high school. So everything she did was with the intent of love, but it wasn't always good. It wasn't always the right thing. But, you know, if she did it, it was loving. She's like, okay. She goes, the next question, all women are, you wrote hot, period. I'm not kidding you, Steve. I'm taking an FBI test, right? And I wrote hot. She goes, why did you write hot? And I go, I tried to spell beautiful three times, but I can't spell beautiful.
Did she laugh?
Yeah, she laughed. She was like, what? She goes, okay, hold on, hold on. She's like, are you dyslexic? She goes, you can't spell, can you? I go, I can't spell. I can't spell, man. I dictate my reports. I can't spell. I said, I'm not kidding you. She goes, so you're trying to keep your sentences short because you don't want to let us know that you can't spell. She goes, okay, well, now we know you're not a liar, at least. This makes sense. And they decide that I am going to actually be a good fit for this role that they want to send me to. And they send me to this long, very extensive training, which to avoid tradecraft and whatever top secrets remain in there, we'll probably leave that there. But I end up going through a really tough selection. I think about 20 people a year at the time were going through, and it had like six, maybe nine would pass. And somehow I passed, and I was now part of this program called the Undercover Employee Program, the Undercover Unit. And I was put into a pile of people that could be canvassed from across the country to work undercover cases. And now I have access to huge resources, large amounts of money. You know, there's a global connection to drugs, probably much like the DEA, I'm sure. And interesting enough, I'm now seeing a perspective of these investigations as a much bigger picture, you know?
You know, I want to bolster up the importance of that school. Because that training, that's probably the premier program in law enforcement worldwide for undercovers. And we've had several prior guests here on Game of Crimes who are graduates of that program. Some of the names you might recognize, Joe Pistone, mm-hmm. Scott mm-hmm. Payne, Jack Garcia, mm-hmm. Dana Ridenour. I mean, these are studs and studettes of the Absolutely. World that have done stuff that's just legendary.
Yes.
I mean, it's just unbelievable things they've done. So I don't want to downplay the significance of you graduating that school. That's phenomenal.
Yeah, not at all. And I thank you for that because I am very proud of that. And there's not very many people in the world that have been through. I mean, I remember going to some of the schools and, you know, foreign governments were not allowed to participate, but they were allowed to observe. You know what I mean? And it was fascinating. It blew my mind how serious they took this program, and it definitely made me feel proud to be a part of a successful person that made it through that program.
Well, you know, Dana told us during her interview about one session where I guess they'd been up for 48, 72 hours, whatever, and just a dog tired, and they were going out to a car, and they popped the trunk, and she realized they were going to try and force her into the back of that trunk, and she fought them. Dana's not a big... But she's not a big lady, but I mean, I think she's like a little banshee when she's ready to go. Somebody's going to go with her. But so they don't pull any punches. I mean, they take your training extremely serious. That's great.
Yeah, I know some of their role players broke some glass with my body during some scenarios training. So definitely like it was some serious stuff, you know. But I think, you know, whether you're doing SWAT tactics or whether you're doing good police training, and we probably don't have enough in the undercover programs, is you've got to create solid scenarios that put your mindset where they possibly could be. So sleep deprivation and high anxiety and fear are good ways to semi create those emotions.
It is. It's, I mean, we still got plenty of time, but I don't want to run out, but I do want to talk about, didn't you partner up with Rocco?
Giovanni Rocco.
Yeah. So let's talk about that, because he's for those of you that have not heard his interview, I suggest you go listen to him here on Game of Crimes or any of the other interviews he's done. His book is fantastic. Yeah. It's one of those you start reading, you can't put it down. But he's investigating the mafia family that they based the TV show The Sopranos on.
Yep.
So these are big time mobsters. I mean, this is pretty cool. So okay, go with your story,
bro. No, yeah, Giovanni Rocco. One of my best buddies, dear friend.
How did he bring you in to work undercover on that?
Oh, hell, I begged him to. I was hoping I could. So I'm going. We will come back. Once you go through that undercover program, they bring active undercovers back to participate in the training of the new recruits as role players or advisors or whatever types of instructors. I would go back and do case presentations about things that are currently actively happening and let them know what they could put themselves into. You know, I mean, working undercover will challenge your family beyond its wildest imaginations. You know, how do you explain to your wife and your kids that, I know you're worried that I might die, but I'm not going to call you for 10 days. Right. And so we would come back to these, training scenarios, and that's where the networking happens. And Giovanni and I became good friends. And we weren't friends at first. I'd never been around a slick talking East Coaster like him before. And,
he sounds like a mobster.
He does sound like a mobster, man. And I love that. I admire that about him now. But at first I was kind of like, what, who? I thought they might have started bringing sources to the school to act as role players or something. Like, this guy was a little too dirty to be, and I knew he wasn't an FBI agent. He ended up being a TFO too, but we became friends, and he had worked biker cases and white supremacist cases and cases like that had a high propensity of violence. Like I was working at the time, and he's like, "Hey Dutch, you know what? You ought to start thinking about working some other cases." He's like, "I'm wearing an Armani suit. I'm going to eat lobster and steak for dinner. I'm staying at Caesars. You're staying at Super 8 or the Red Roof Inn." You know what I mean? And I'm like, dang, man. I'm like, you're right. He's driving a Cadillac Escalade. You know what I mean? So we got to be good friends. And because he had worked in the biker cases before he went into the mafia side of things, cleaned up, as you would say, got rid of the earrings, mm-hmm. suited up, he was working in the same stuff that I was. So he calls me one day. He's like, "We have become very good friends, and you know, we got to take care of each other, right? Like, you and Javier or anybody you probably worked with, certain ones, you know, when something's bothering them and it's hard on them and you need to be there for them, right?" And he'd called me one time. He was coming toward the end of a 2 or 3 year long case inside the De Cavalcante crime family out of New Jersey. And Giovanni's from New Jersey, so it was close to home. It was affecting his family greatly. And the case was coming to an end. They want him to kill some guys. And because Giovanni, I think he was about to be made, he had a capo, and he was running his own crew legally with the U.S. attorney's permission to be doing the things he was doing. And he said, "Right. Dutch, I need your help. I need you to come out to Vegas. These guys want me to kill somebody, a couple of somebodies." And I'm like, "Giovanni, I don't know nothing about the mob. Like, what do you want me to do?" He's like, "You know, he's like, actually, that's what's perfect." He's like, "If you're in deep with us, like, if they say kill somebody, you don't get to ask questions. You just figure out how to do it." And so he basically arranged where he had told his capo, "Hey, if I do it or we use our crew or my crew, it's going to come back on us because this isn't a sanctioned hit." And he said, "Let me introduce you to Dutch." You know, and he described it before. He was a mafia guy. He was a biker guy. And me and him were basically like cousins, you know, we were cousins, even though I wasn't like him and he wasn't like me anymore. He knew me and trusted me. And it would make sense that I could whack these dudes out for him and it wouldn't get them into trouble. So Giovanni brought me out to Las Vegas, man. Tell you what, that's probably the best undercover case I've ever eaten such good food on. You know, we're staying in nice hotels. We got drinking money and partying money. And even though he's stressed out, I'm having a good time because I'm not really in danger. You know what I mean? Giovanni's living, walking and talking in that role. And I'm there, like you kind of mentioned earlier, like when you're working undercover, there's a primary. Sometimes there's a supportive role. Sometimes there's people who really aren't that significant, but they're there. And this particular one, I was definitely a supportive role. I was the hired hitman, if you will. And it worked out good. We had a lot of success. Giovanni had a lot of success, and I assisted with that success by just looking cool.
I love it, man. And I mean, look at you guys now. It's just like me and Javier. After all these years, we're still partners.
Yeah, and you know, I learned talking about, I've been around, I've seen a lot of things, but the East Coast is a special place. It's totally different, right? On the East Coast, Miami's crazy. It's unique, but it's a lot of Colombian and Cuban and cocaine stuff. The East Coast is like having the whole world, especially New York, New Jersey, New York City. It's like having the whole world in one city, right? And he taught me about things I'd never heard of. Like, you guys probably did a lot of the like untaxed cigarette takeoffs, you know?
No,
ATF did it. Yeah. Well, ATF took the cigarettes, and then Giovanni taught me how to use the cigarettes.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woo-hoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Because I would get pallets and pallets of Newport 100s, and I would trade them for cocaine and all kinds of stuff. But I wouldn't have even known how to access that stuff if I hadn't met Giovanni. Oh, he would send me like boxes of football jerseys, like NFL football jersey swag that had been taken off from whatever, a truckload of, got robbed by some mafia guy or something, and they had put it into evidence. And the U.S. attorney agreed that it could be used for case work. I was selling them and trading them for drugs and making this good introduction. And so basically once I met him and I helped him with that mafia case, we kind of developed our own persona, like Dutch and Giovanni. He would call me and be like, ah, hey, Dutch ain't going to like this. You don't want to meet Dutch. You know what I mean? And I would do the same thing. I might be working a gang case in some city that is on the West Coast or in the Midwest or somewhere else. So they have never had exposure to the mafia, but they've watched it. They've seen it. Right. And I could just put Giovanni on speakerphone and be like, I'm like, hey, Giovanni, Dutch. He's like, fuck Dutch. What do you want? He'd talk real fast, dismiss me like I wasn't important. Like, you got any more of them cigarettes? Jesus Christ. You want the cigarettes again with the cigarettes? And these guys would hear it. And they all of a sudden thought, oh, Dutch is connected to the mob in New York City. All I had to do is let him listen to Giovanni talk and show up with some swag and some cigarettes, and I was in control. You know, it worked. It was a very good relationship that way.
I love it. I mean, it's theater. It's street theater. Yeah. Right?
It's smart street smart, you know?
Absolutely. And you're right. You have got to be thinking on your toes continuously. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. There was just a little side note. We were doing an undercover down in Miami, and a buddy of mine, J.P. Foster, who was with GBI, Georgia Bureau of Investigation at the time, had come down. We're working with South Miami PD, and we're meeting these Colombians out at a rest stop off of one of the – I think it's off the turnpike maybe. And the we had a mobile home set up inside, an RV set up in the parking lot, because, you know, travelers are traveling RVs, and it was a great surveillance platform.
Yeah.
And you can get close enough so the transmitters actually work.
Oh, yeah. You know, you could actually hear them.
And things weren't going good with the deal, and they were starting to make a lot of demands, and we were looking for a way to get out of it. And I said, I got it. You know, and I said, just keep them talking for a minute. I walked over to his car, and he must have had 10 PBA, Police Benevolent Association, stickers on the back of his window, thinking, you know, he was making donations, thinking I'd get him out of ticket. And I turned around, I looked at that, and I got wide eyed. And I turned around to the other undercover. I'm like, this guy's a cop. We got to go.
Yeah.
And he's like, what are you talking about, a cop? And I said, look at the stickers on your car, you idiot.
Yeah.
You think we're stupid? You know, and I mean, it was a lot more forceful, the discussion at that point.
You turned it on him.
But, you know, absolutely. And it just, things like that just pop into your head. But that's what keeps you alive when you're under the, you know, when you're working undercover. Not that we were in a situation anything like yours. But you never know when the Colombian is going to have a hitman out there with.
Yeah, you're right about that. And, you know, it's, you said a situation like mine. When you're working undercover, you never know what the situation is. You know, most of the time in police work, you have control of the room, right? Once you show up, you got the gun, you got the badge, you got the authority. People do what you say. And if they don't, use of force happens. When you're undercover, you have control of the briefing room. You have a great story and a great plan, but the second you walk through the threshold and you step into the undercover world, you no longer have any control of the room. Anything can happen anytime. The guy you're working with maybe isn't a danger to you at all, but somebody in his crew has been a little jealous and seen all this money coming around. And while you two are trying to do a deal that's really got no confrontation and nothing wrong, he might just come in and shoot everybody and take the money in the dope, or rivals. I mean, anything can happen, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You just never know. Always on your toes. Were you involved in human trafficking cases?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Now, tell us a little bit about that, because that's just lately that's become a kind of a sore spot for me.
Yeah. You know, I know what you're saying. I don't want to take away from anybody who's been a victim of a sex crime. Okay. I'm only speaking from my own experience. And so we did a long-term human trafficking case on the East Coast. There used to be a site called Backpage, and we would get canvas for these undercovers. And Big Country and I, Scott Payne and I, worked on one for quite a while together. And we had a lot of fun on that. We can talk about some funny stories. I'll tell you one about him, but,
he's hilarious.
Oh God, he is so funny. And he's a great, wonderful, stable, secure, awesome, fun dude to be around. You know what I mean? But this case, Backpage is where you'd go to hire escorts. And I think there's kind of this misconception that like women are kidnapped and snatched off the streets and chained to beds, and then men are just paying money to have sex with them. And that's not how human trafficking works. The movie Taken, at least in my experience, is not very accurate, right? They're not grabbing girls and doping them up and tying them to beds. That's not how it works. Most of these girls are probably under more of a manipulation, right? Like they're extorted for money. They have no other means to make a living. A person or an organization comes and makes them feel safe, makes them feel like they'll take care of them, and then provides them the means to make money through sex work. It was a Chinese organized crime case where basically they knew that the Chinese were trafficking humans to the East Coast, and they weren't only using them for sex crimes. They were using them for labor and everything else. But brilliant guy, his name was Brian. Brian Getzen was his name. He's the FBI agent, case agent, wonderful guy. And he had come up with this plan to where Big Country and some other officers, Cooper and a couple other guys, some undercover employees would come out, get on Backpage and look up prostitutes. Bring them in, make a date with them, right? And we had local task force officers there too. But the whole point of the work wasn't necessary to arrest a prostitute on a misdemeanor, local, state, or street crime, but instead to gather intelligence. We had people that spoke Mandarin. We had counselors. We had lots of investigative resources available. And the purpose of this was we'd get a girl, get her caught up, just like flipping a source, right? Make 2-3 buys off them. Then, hey, who do you know? Where do you get it? What do you do? The girls would come in. They'd agree to commit a sex act, basically making them probable cause to be arrested. We'd say, we're not interested in arresting you. Tell us about the street. Do you have a pimp? Does someone make you do this? When we tried to learn as much as we can, we'd found during this that the Chinese at the time were running a gambling operation in China. And these men would run up these large debts, and instead of being able to pay the debts, they would come to them and say, hey, we'll take your wife or your daughter or both. We'll take them to the U.S. and we're going to put them to work in a restaurant. And I remember this one girl that I hired off of Backpage. She came in, she spoke decent English, and she provided a mass amount of information and intelligence about how this particular organization worked. She was brought here under the guise that she was going to pay back a gambling debt. They took her ID away. They gave her a cell phone, which is basically a burner phone, you know, a flip phone that was prepaid. And the only thing in her purse was condoms, cigarettes, and this phone. And she was doing like 10 or 12 dates a night. And I know it's disgusting and it's horrible. And anytime she went anywhere, she was driven by one of the male organized crime guys. They might show up in a Mercedes or BMW. He'd drop her off. She'd go in and make her deal. She'd come back out, pay them the money. They had several houses set up, New York, Philly, I think Virginia, I don't know, a couple different places out there. They had these different residents set up where they'd keep the girls. When I say keep them, they weren't locked down. They could run away, but where are they going to run? You know what I mean? Who are they going to call? Like most of them barely spoke English and they wouldn't even know who to call. And this particular girl that came into the room that night, I remember they were like, we'll help you. Let's get you out of this. And she was like, no. So what do you think is going to happen? Like, you're going to send me back to China and I'm just going to live happily ever after? Like, we'll starve. They'll kill us. I'm going to stay here and work. And so she voluntarily on her own accord stayed and continued to work and continued to provide information. But basically they were trafficking these girls over and putting them to work in the sex trade. And it made prosecution difficult because a lot of them didn't want to cooperate. You know, they were fearful that someone would hurt them or kill them or members of their family. And it made it really difficult to develop a prosecutable case, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's there was a former guest on here. I've had her on here twice. Natasha Herzig, who was taken against her will. I think she was 19 years old, San Jose, California. And the way they coerced her through, other than beatings, I mean, they almost killed her a couple of times. This one guy named Spider, who's doing life in prison for this. They would take her in the car and he'd give her a pair of binoculars. He'd park about two blocks away from where her family lived. And when he'd see the family come out, he'd say, now, take a look at that. And she'd see her mom and her dad and her little brother and her pet dog and all that. He said, if you ever leave me, I'll come back and kill them all.
He was a pimp, right?
And she was, yeah. And she was in it for quite some time. And then I think they were in New York and he'd beat this one girl, if I'm remembering the story correctly, almost killed her. And Natasha said, this is it. You know, we've got to get her some help, and took her to the hospital. Of course, the police showed up. I think they were in New York City. And FBI got involved, and she's not a fan of the FBI at all, but she loves NYPD.
Yeah.
And was able to get out of it. Now she works for an organization, a nonprofit that helps victims get out of the circumstances, you know, provide support, counseling, all that.
Yeah, no, and I think it's important to bring that. That's a good point, because I said they aren't just kidnapped and chained to beds. That doesn't mean they're not taken, you know, but it's not quite like that movie portrays it. And you're right. Then that was the point of what we were doing. We're only because the predicated target was the Chinese organized crime group. That's what we were focusing on. But anybody that we brought in and had agreed to do a date, we would be, you know, talk to them. Do you have a pimp? How does it work? The Russians had a row house, and they were bringing girls in, and they were doing all the online hookups. They were taking all the money. They were doing everything. It's definitely real. It happens. It exists. It's violent. It's disgusting. It's dirty. But I think it's a tough thing to investigate, and we have prioritized it as a country to do better about it. But I think it's a difficult investigation and an even more difficult prosecution, because the girls are beat and are seriously manipulated and in fear, and they just don't make good witnesses. They don't give good testimony. You know what I mean?
Right. And I've been working with a couple of groups here, Aerial Recovery here in the U.S. and Libertas International out of Medellin, Colombia. Specifically, there's several others, but they're just heartbreaking.
Yeah, they are.
It just kills you. Now, did you work outlaw motorcycle gangs also?
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
Look at you laughing, man. That's supposed to be a good story.
Well, no, I mean, I don't know if it's a good story. You know, when you're doing this stuff, it just seems normal, right? Like every time you go on a case, it just feels normal, and you kind of forget the stuff you've done and the things you've seen and the things you've been through. So, you know, switch from which was relatively light lifting, where I'm just hiring prostitutes to come to the hotel room to collect intelligence, and then go back into, you know, the biker gang club stuff. I did do that. I worked undercover on two different pretty significant motorcycle clubs. One in California and one in Indiana.
Can you say who they are? If you don't want to, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think I can. I just don't. I guess the best way to cover that is to say that the whole entire club was a target or that it was sanctioned. In my experience, they weren't. Like in Giovanni's case, the mafia, they pay up. You know, your street guys pay up to the capo. The capo pays up to whoever's next, and so on and so forth. I didn't find in the clubs that it wasn't such an organized thing. It's like members of the club were committing crimes, but if a member of the club sold dope, he didn't pay up to the president, the national president that I know of. I'm not saying it didn't happen or don't know if I don't, I just didn't, that just wasn't my experience that that's what was happening. So my undercover work with these motorcycle clubs usually targeted individuals within the club. And I'm not saying they weren't all committing crimes. I'm just saying, even though we did indictments and people were indicted, it was individuals that were indicted, not the whole club, if that makes sense. And I did work undercover in the Northern Valley chapter of the Vagos. And I worked undercover on another club case, but they were into some pretty serious stuff. And I probably won't, I don't think I'd, that's fine. Better not say their names. You know what I mean? I'd tell you about that off air sometime.
Yeah, we've had, I've had a couple of former presidents from different, from one for the Vagos, one from the HAs, Hell's Angels on here. Occasionally we bring a former bad guy here on Game of Crime.
Yeah.
And they have to have cooperated, admitted responsibility for their crimes, that type of thing. Although the one from the HAs didn't. And some of my listeners were a little bit upset about that. But, you know, it's I don't bring them on here to glorify them. It's for us, law enforcement, military, or those that are interested to keep your families away from these people. You learn about them and what it is they target. So for those of you that were offended by that, I do apologize. But that was, you know, I'm not doing it just to, for him to glorify himself.
Yeah. You know, I think that's, I mean, we've been talking about learning and making sure you never stop learning all the time. I don't, you know, I totally see your point on that. If bringing a bad guy on the show isn't a bad thing, if you're, if a lot of your listening groups in law enforcement or even military, what, we're not much different than each other. So, I mean, club members and bad guys and good guys can be pretty close. You know, we have a lot of similar personality traits, and it's, hey, I hate to say it, but there's a lot of law enforcement clubs that have assimilated pretty damn close to being outlaw clubs, you know, and they should check themselves a little bit, because that's not okay. So bringing a bad guy on the show and learning some lessons from them and learning how they perceive us and what their perception of us is and what they look for or what their indicators are, that's a benefit. Take the opportunity to learn something from it, you know?
That's the way I see it. That's the way I see it. And I know there's other podcasts out there that'll bring them on also. I think you guys on your podcast do that occasionally. But it is a true learning experience.
Yeah, we brought a Mongols president on named Mooch, and he was articulate. And he, if he minimized anything, I'm not aware of it. But, I mean, you know, the purpose of these shows isn't always to make a judgment, right? I mean, we're just talking about life experiences and things that we've been through as individuals. And I would feel bad if they're offended by anything I say too, but that's not the intent.
Yeah. No, and I don't think they would be. We got great people here on Game of Crime.
Yeah.
We got the best listeners. You guys should be jealous of us.
I am.
No, you guys are killing it out there with the Mob Museum. I mean, that's fantastic. It's all the thing. I guess the big difference is it's professional. You got professional editing. The studio's professional. You and Rocco are two of the best interviewers. You know how to elicit information out of people.
Well, it's all about having resources. You know, we got a lot more resources available there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's me and Connie here. That's my wife.
Yeah, I figured that.
She's a good egg. Did you do any undercover operations outside the United States?
I'd say anything global wouldn't be something we would talk about for sure. You know what I mean? And I will say,
if you're having to think that hard, let's
you know,
keep going.
Yeah, right. You know what I mean? I don't know where the clear. I don't know where. What the status of those are? You know what I'm saying? Start getting into national security stuff and things like that. It starts becoming a little more careful about what you say publicly, because I don't want to get myself in trouble.
Absolutely. Well, so what was your most dangerous assignment where maybe you came really close to death, other than the car dealership?
Well, you want to talk about a topic some people don't want to hear about, and that's dirty cops. You know,
That's fine, because nobody hates a bad cop more than a good
cop.
That's
right. That's exactly right. They should be ashamed of themselves. And I don't have any use for a dirty cop, because when you put that badge on and you swear and you agree, I mean, people in desperate times are calling you and expecting that you're the one that they can trust. You're supposed to be the only one they can trust. You know what I mean? They're caught between two worlds of whatever, and they're saying, hey, I need your help. If you're a bad cop and you're using that badge to extort people or self-gratify yourself, I don't have much use for it. None. I'm not saying I can't forgive somebody, but you don't have no business being – you're not a cop. You're a bad guy anyway. So I was working it'd be a money laundering case. It was definitely for a cartel-related investigation. And I had bought like an $80,000 Humvee. And I told them it's drug money. This is going to be this. This is what I'm doing with it. And I'd given them like $25,000 in cash. And I had gotten the information I needed to support the structuring and money laundering side of that. And at some point, we decided that we didn't need to pay this guy the rest of their money. If I give him 25 and I owed him 80, I took the Humvee, but I didn't pay him the rest of the money. Well, that pissed them off, as you can imagine, in the criminal world, because these were some serious, serious people. It was a Mexican cartel group, and we didn't pay this guy their money. So, man, sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, right? You want to talk about dangerous? This is dangerous, and it's dirty. But I remember when it happened. I was like, "What do you mean? Do you want me to take the Humvee and drive around in it, and just keep walking on the street and keep working my cases? But if we don't pay this guy the money I owe him, he's gonna be a pit. He thinks I'm a street guy. He's gonna hold me accountable as a street guy. You know what I mean? He doesn't think I'm a cop. He thinks I owe him $50,000 at least. Well, we didn't pay him the money." So I get a call from a good friend of mine. You know how we go to trainings? Like, when you work covert and you work undercover, you're not in – I don't go to the police briefings all that often, right? You have an award ceremony. You don't get your awards, and you're not around the other cops as much. But when you go to specialized training, you get to be exposed to other cops. So one of the guys that I had become – I actually went to firearms instructor school, because I could work – I kind of like to teach, and I like to be in passing on some of the things that I had learned. It's very fulfilling to teach new, young law enforcement people things you've learned. It's a gratifying thing. So I went to a firearms instructor school, and I made good friends, this guy named Steve and this other guy. Rest in peace. He didn't make it, but we went to undercover. We went to a firearm school together. So Steve calls me one day. He goes, "Hey, Dutch, funny thing." I go, "What?" And he goes, "I was just up in the detective bureau on a different floor, and I walked by a desk and I saw a picture of you, but it wasn't your name." I'm like, "Oh, yeah? Why?" He goes, "I don't know. I didn't ask." You know what I mean? He goes, "I know what you do." And I'm like, "All right, well, maybe you should go up and ask him what he has." He's like, "Okay." So he walked back up there. He called me back right away, and he goes, "Hey, man, I didn't ask him, but he's got three pictures of you, and one of them's your real identity." I'm like, "Really?" I go, "Is he a bad guy, or is he a dumbass, or like, what's the deal?" And he goes, "I don't know, man, but it don't look good, you know?" And I'm like, "Okay." So I called my supervisor, the FBI, and I'm like, "Hey, Kevin, we got a problem, man. This other detective that I know from another department was walking by a desk, and he's got three of my undercover identities and my real identity on his desk." I was in the middle of about a year and a half long-term undercover case with the money laundering and some drugs and a bunch of other stuff I was doing with some serious people. And it was coming to an end, but it wasn't ready to end yet. They shut the whole operation down. FBI went and snatched this guy up, got a hold of his captain, everybody else. Long story short, this guy was an on-duty detective who had been working for the cartel. This guy that I was doing the money laundering with, I didn't pay him the money, and so he hired him to find me. Now, and if we're going to do the money laundering right, and if we're going to do this thing right, I bought a car from him. I had to fill out paperwork, so I had a title to the car, right? So then I'd pay 80 grand for the car, but they give me a bill of sale for like 15 grand. Well, I'd filled out the paperwork using one of my, it was a light stop backed identity, a covert identity that we used for, you know, burners. But this cop was a pretty damn good cop. I mean, he's a bad guy, but he had a badge and a gun, and he had a detective's badge. So he, turns out they interrogated him, they interviewed him, and they said, you know, the NCIC program where you run people's name and histories and all that stuff through there. He had actually cross-referenced my height, weight, and description through NCIC and found two of my undercover identities, and he had my real name and my real address, and he had my immediate family's workplaces and everything. And and he'd already turned it over to the cartel guy who had a local gang. He already put a hit on me. And it was a blood family gang had gotten the hit from him. And so they went into kind of a panic mode. We did a bunch of search warrants, took down the case I was working on. And my kids I lived in a really nice neighborhood, and I didn't look like nobody really knew what I did. But for several weeks, you know, there was people sitting around the neighborhood wearing FBI jackets, and my kids were getting escorted to and from school. And my wife at the time was super pissed off because, you know, our life had been interrupted and I'd put us in danger. They do not like that at all.
Not at all.
No. And also this nice, close-knit neighborhood that we all lived in and went to soccer practices to and lived our lives in all of a sudden was saturated with people wearing blue FBI jackets. You know, they don't like that either. And so that probably was, honestly, a dirty cop's probably the closest I came to really – I mean, I've been in different things to shoot out the car dealership. I've had guns pointed at me and stuff like that. But if you're going to be real serious about it, that was probably the closest that I came. Or more importantly, I'd accepted that if you're going to do this kind of work, you could catch a bullet. You could get killed, right? And you do reach a moment of acceptance with that. But my family hadn't agreed to that. My young kids hadn't agreed to that, and my neighbors hadn't agreed to that. So that was kind of a wake up call for me to be, you know, more attentive to the fact that people you work with can't always be trusted either. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
Sucks.
That takes it to a whole different level.
That sucks. When you bring the family. Yeah, that sucks.
That is completely off limits. So, all right. So after all these adventures, and there's tons more, but we're running short on time. Why did you decide to retire from law enforcement?
Yeah, I'd reached my limit. You know what I mean? Your family life is greatly affected by your, not just undercover work. Law enforcement in general is hard on your family, whether you're wearing a uniform. Honestly, you're wearing a uniform, pushing a cruiser and beating the streets. I think that's some of the hardest times on you and your family.
I agree.
For sure. That was the hardest work I ever did. And it's just hard. But working undercover, it's a different kind of stress. Like, you know, I look the way I look and I talk the way I talk. And I mean, I didn't even carry a gun anymore. Half the time I didn't know where my gun or my badge was unless we were doing something that had to do with enforcement. And I started to kind of feel disconnected from the law enforcement community. I started to kind of feel alone, not complaining, not whining about it at all. I just, some things were happening personally in my life at home. I was seeing my kids be hurt and not understanding where I was all the time and why I was so anxious. I became very anxious and very high strung. And I just reached a threshold. I was like, you know what? I don't want to do this another single day. I went on a Wednesday. I said, I'm never coming back. And they were like, what, you taking the rest of the day off, the rest of the week off? I just reached my threshold and I was like, that's it. And in order to maintain sanity, there is life after the badge. There's a life after law enforcement, probably much like the military. And it's a very satisfying life too. I guess I was just tired of living in a glass box and just tired of carrying that weight. I got what I wanted out of it. I'd gotten and been very satisfied from it. And I wanted to leave with a clear head.
Excellent. And that's one of the smartest things people can do is know when it's time.
For sure.
Yeah, you know, my whole career, I said I would ask senior guys or guys that were retiring, how do you know when it's time to go? Because I, you know, ended up being a cop for 38 years. And every one of them would say, when it's time, you'll know. And I'm like, well, that didn't help me a damn bit. But you know what? When the time came, I knew.
Yeah, you knew real clearly, didn't you?
They do. You do. And you just shocked my whole family. I mean, it was, it helped the, you know, that Netflix Narcos came along about that time. But my oldest son even said that. He said, like, Dad, what are you going to do? You are DEA. That's what you are.
Yeah.
So it was, but anyway, so what are you doing in life after law enforcement?
Oh, I guess I'm a small entrepreneur, if you will. You know, I found things that are important to me. I don't need the adrenaline as much as I used to. I find my adrenaline in the outside. I'm a big off-roader and, you know, we do a lot of rock climbing and stuff like that. I find my adrenaline there. I don't need to have a propensity for violence to get adrenaline anymore. I own a couple of businesses. I do the podcast at the Mob Museum, which I'm sure you know because you're doing it too. Talking about it's been pretty therapeutic. Getting those, telling those stories is pretty rewarding. And like you, when you're living a covert life like we did, you keep them, even, you know, everything about DEA is covert all the time. And it's kind of unfair to your friends and your family, your neighbors, because they want to be proud of you and they want to know what you've been up to and they want to know the things you've done. And when you work covertly, no one knows. So when you finally get to tell the stories like we are, it's pretty rewarding. And my kids are like, they're like, oh man, Dad, like, you were so pissed off all the time. Now we know why, but that's cool. You know what I mean? Like that, we love you. Like we appreciate you.
Yep. So, and you going to tell us about your other business or do I need to tell them?
Oh, about my barbershop?
Yeah. Hollow Cove. Hollow Cove. Is that
yeah.
it?
Yeah. I'm a barber. I own a barbershop and that's been a good business for me because, you know, I'm a good talker and I can't stop talking. So, I get you locked in my chair for 30 minutes. You got to listen to me talk whether you want to or not.
That's great, man. That is fantastic. You know, I would come and see you for a haircut, but there's not a whole lot. You know, I'd be in there like 3 minutes. You know,
I
get out.
I still charge you $25.
Yeah, you would. Man, this has been a lot of fun, Dutch. Thank you so much again for coming. But before you go, are there any words of wisdom that you would like to offer? Maybe those who are considering a life in law enforcement or just a life of serving others. Cause in my book, you know, the good man upstairs, he says in his book, there's no higher calling than serving your fellow man. So got anything you want to leave us with?
Yeah. I think, if you're going to go into law enforcement, remember your integrity. If you can't work with integrity and you can't be, it's okay to make a mistake. It's a law enforcement is one of the hardest jobs to do because they expect you to be a mental health expert and they expect you to conflict resolution, solve problems, do all these things, figure out car wrecks, do all this stuff. It's okay to make mistakes, be honest about it, tell the truth, always, always maintain your integrity. And don't forget that we work for the public. We work for the people that have entrusted us with such an amount of power and authority. You get to carry a gun and a badge. And when you swear out an affidavit of arrest, you are taking someone's life from them. So make sure you do that integrity. Have empathy, be sympathetic, and try to have some understanding. I'm not saying that you have to agree with bad guys, but recognize humanity. I think that's very important.
Excellent. Man, I mean, you just knocked it out of the park. I agree 100% with everything you said. Just because we're public servants, that's not a derogatory term. In my book, that's a term of it's a heroic term. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't make you more important than anybody else.
Nope.
The guys, it's like you said, the guys in uniform, they show up. People are looking for somebody to take charge, and that's what the uniforms are expected to do. So that's why we have utmost respect for them. That is the hardest job out there.
By far.
When you're working undercover and like with DEA, you know, you're working these cases covertly, and the bad guys might know that you're looking at them. I mean, they all say, I knew who you were. I knew you were a cop. Well, what the heck did you deal with me for? How stupid are you, right? But it's the to the point where when we're ready to go get them, we go in force and we go in to win. Whereas a uniform makes a traffic stop, just like, you know, that they could have left you laying on that road out there.
Yeah.
All by yourself and nobody found you for, you know, till shift change. Yep. And then they have to come find you. So thank you so much for that, brother. It's been a true honor. Thank you to your family, who we refer to as the unsung heroes, for letting me have a couple hours of your time, but also putting up with your crap and my family putting up with my crap to do what we loved. You know, we loved what we did.
Heck yeah.
So I always give them a shout out. I tried to find Dutch here on a couple of places. Check out the Inside the Life podcast with Giovanni Rocco and Dutch McAlpin.
Right,
yep. And if you happen to be in Vegas, check out the Mob Museum.
For sure.
I know that they still have a lot of our Javier and I's stuff out there from the Escobar days and all that stuff. And that, they told us they were going to put a whole new display up, but I don't know if it's up yet or not. I know they're doing a lot of remodeling out there. But anyway, stop by and see them, and you might be lucky enough to run into Rocco and Dutcher. You never know.
Hey, you
know, I did find you. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I was going to say, like, to punch that, when you're the podcaster and you're interviewing people, there's a lot left out about you. So for your fans, if they want to know more about you, they should check out season 2 of Inside the Life, where you're a guest on that show. And man, you'll learn a lot about Steve and the depth that he has and just what a wonderful human and servant he's been to our nation. And you'll appreciate him even more. And that's not to push Inside the Life's podcast, but it's a moment to, for you to know your guest, your host.
Oh, thank you, man. I'll bounce you a check out to you. You're making me blush here. I tried to find a little bit more about you on Instagram. I put your name in and it came up Inside the Life. So it's a podcast there. And there's a lot of little clips in there. So go take a look at those. And then on Facebook, check out Hollow Cove Barbershop. And that's where you'll find the man.
Right on.
Dutch, brother, thank you again. I can't say thank you enough. I'm looking forward to the next time we get together.
Me too.
If you're ever in Orlando, give me a shout, brother. We'll go share a meal, or, you know, we'll tell more war stories.
Right on.
I love it.
Thanks, Steve.
And for all, my pleasure, man. And for all our listeners, thank you very much for coming back every week. I truly appreciate you. If you haven't checked us out on Patreon, go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Come and look at some of the stupid things I do over there, because, you know, I do a lot of stupid things here on the regular podcast. And those people pay me to do them. So come on over. And while we're thinking about it, you know, think about why you keep coming back each week. And I know why you keep coming back, because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all. And that's the game of crimes. God bless. See you folks next week. Stay safe out there.
To have fun anytime, anywhere. Step 1, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step 2, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa Welcome Bonus.
Step 3, play hundreds of casino style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step 4, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.